Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with Life Coach Cindy Chavez, and this is your daily dose of happy. We're so happy you decided to join us today. And I was doing research before the show today, Cindy, because I'm not sure if you're aware. I think I sent you an email, but I'm not sure you even saw the email. I'm kind of branching out a little bit, trying to start a new career as a public speaker, something to add on to being the podcast host. And there's a lot of work to be done to just learn the field, first of all, which is what I'm doing. I've been, you know, buying books and all that kind of thing, and then kind of planning out what I'm going to do. And the thing that I wanted to bring in here is that it's amazing how easily you can dive into something. And if you don't do it from a high vibe point of view, it will drown you. Doesn't matter how much you like it.
Right. Like you feel overwhelmed with learning.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because every single thing, it doesn't matter what it is, there's like a whole subculture devoted to it, and it goes wider and deeper than you ever dreamed was possible, right? No matter what it is. It's like you can pick the most crazy topic, and there's like a whole community that knows everything about it. It is really wild when that happens. And yeah,
it is.
That's for sure, especially if you're thinking about like directing yourself into it. It can be really overwhelming to realize how much information there is, right?
We're not talking rabbit holes here either. We're talking like, you know, backhoe type holes. We're talking monumental holes that you're going down.
I know one of the things that I did when I was getting into more public speaking, and I, besides this podcast right now, I mean, I do a few things, but not a lot. But back then I was like thinking I would be doing more, and, or I was looking into it. And so I joined Toastmasters.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And because everyone said, this is what you need to do. You need to join Toastmasters. And it actually was a really good experience for me. But in some ways it was so funny because one of the things they do in Toastmasters is, you know, those little bells, like you see at the concierge desk, bing, bing, bing.
Right, right.
Well, they have a bell, and it's like when you get up to speak, there are a bunch of things that are no-nos, like saying, that's a no-no, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yep.
I just did it. I just did it, and then I did it like for reals. I just went, Okay, so every time you would, someone would ring that bell. And so they say, okay, here's what we want you to do. We want you to come up here and tell us about, now give you some topic to speak on that anyone could talk about. Like tell us about your favorite vacation or something, right? So you're not like searching for answers. You just to start telling a story. Tell us how you feel about whatever. 3 minutes. Okay, go. Oh my goodness. Bing, 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 bing. I never realized how much I did all those things that were on the checklist of don't do this if you're a public speaker. And one of them was, bing.
I would describe that as the reverse Skinnerian effect. You're going to be scared away from public speaking because every time you hear a bell go off, you're going to say, no, I can't do this.
Exactly. So it can be really useful to put yourself in that situation and get some of that feedback and training and realize some of the things that we do that we might not even notice because they're so part of how we present ourselves. And that was a good thing, I think, for me to just experience it.
I'm reading the second of four books that I purchased from professional speakers trying to teach other people how to be speakers, public speakers. And this guy that I'm reading right now, interesting guy. He writes in 20-point type on about 100 pages. So we're not talking about a long message here. And his biggest point that he's made two big points so far. The first big point is that there are three bullet points that can kill you. Perfectionism, perfectionism, perfectionism. So I remember that one pretty easily. And then the other thing he said is, you can basically sweep most of the stuff out of the way that everybody says that you need. All you really need is basically to go speak. Now, his was actually a four item list, but that's really what it added up to. It added up to get a topic and go talk. And I thought, well, that's pretty much right to the point, isn't it? I mean, you don't get to mess around a whole lot thinking about, well, geez, I got to have my website and I got to make my special video and I have to pre-work the talk. I need an outline. How many talks do I need to do? Well, I need to have long. You don't go through all that. You go talk.
that is great advice for anybody wanting to do anything. Because so often, for instance, I was talking to someone recently and they were really stressed out about their website.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there was so much more to their business. And I was telling them, look, the website is like, it's just busy work that you're thinking about a lot and stressing over instead of actually doing, giving your gift to the world, doing the thing that you want to be doing.
Right.
Don't worry about it. And I told them, you know, I've said this a lot to people, and that is that eBay and Google both have two of the sort of ugliest, you know, websites in the world, and they're the biggest websites in the world, right? It's like, stop worrying about it. Because we do that. We give ourselves lots of things to be concerned about instead of just going for the main item and just getting out there and doing the thing, whatever it is. So congratulations on your decision to research and get into this. That's fun. See, I'm really cognizant every time I go, I'm waiting for a bell to ring. So
you're actually primed to say, I mean, any time that you have said in the past is now coming back to haunt you, so that it's just dominating. It's like those tapes we talk about. It's one of those subconscious tapes that's now playing again.
Seriously.
Oh, it's crazy. Anyway, we have an email that came in from one of our listeners who has written to us before, and I wanted to bring it up. And this is kind of a little bit of an oddball topic for us, but I figured, hey, why not? Let's take a swing at it. I think it could be fun. He says, hi, wonderful team. I wanted to know if you people who understand how LOA works, do you really care how much data is collected on you? It seems to me that in the grand scheme of things, Big Brother is nothing compared to what the universe knows about us, which is unconditional and without judgment. Any thoughts? I would appreciate. Again, that's from Avinash. So I'm going to let you go first. What do you think?
Well, it's an interesting query. I think that, first of all, when people say the universe, what are they talking about, right? Like, what am I talking about when I say the universe? The powers that be that are the greater powers that be. Am I talking about planets? Am I talking about what people refer to as what or who people may refer to as God? I think all of those get involved in it. Sometimes people say the universe because they distinctly don't want to have a specifically religious overtone to what they're saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? They don't maybe hold to a certain religion, so they don't want to accidentally be thrown in that pile over there that's, you know, Christian or Jewish or Catholic or, you know, Muslim or whatever. They don't want to be. So they say the universe. I say the universe, and I think of the universe as everything. All of the energy, which we're all connected to, the rocks and the trees and the earth and us, the humans, the animals, like everything is all connected. So when I say the universe, I'm really speaking of all, the all, what the Kabbalion would say, the all, what the alchemists would call the one, the all, everything. So I think that's important because we're comparing what the question says is Big Brother.
Yes.
Right? Which I don't believe is seen as this kind of metaphysical, metaphorical all, but as the government or the military or whatever, a very human kind of being or what's the word I'm looking for? System, group, and agency.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think that the universe, I think the universe is a reflection of all of us. And so I think of the universe as being neutral, sort of, if you could be sort of neutral, right? I mean, I kind of look at it this way. Sometimes we manifest things that are directly related to what I would call our shadows.
Yes, I agree.
Right? So maybe we're manifesting strife or stress or lack and part of us is sort of digging it. Like part of us has a payoff for those things. oh, I've been trying and trying and trying, you know, to get this thing over here to work and it's not working. Well, what's the payoff? Well, you know, if this system over here isn't working for me, then someone else will pick up the slack, right? Someone will take care of me. Maybe that's, there's always some kind of payoff. And I think when I used to say all the time, the universe is always supporting you. And people may say, I had someone on more than one occasion say, well, I don't, the universe isn't supporting me. I don't feel like the universe is supporting me. Why? Because they were having trouble in their life at that time. So they didn't feel supported in the way we say, oh, I feel so supported and taken care of. And the truth was that the universe was supporting their story.
True. Yes.
Right. Like how often do we say things like the really good ones we use all the time because people relate to it is, oh, I'm terrible at math. Or how about I never remember names? Mm-hmm. Like if you had a dollar for every time someone said to you, oh, I never forget a face, but I can never remember a name, you know,
I'd be well off.
That's how, 10 bucks, right? So
yeah,
people say
at least
these are stories that people say. And I think the universe supports that. So my husband will tell you, I'm a stickler for like calling people out. And of course he calls me out if I do it, but those self-talk things where we say, oh, I can't do anything right. You know, we mess up with something and we say, oh, I can't do anything right. And I always say, don't say that because your subconscious hears it and says, okay. Mm-hmm. And starts consciously making sure that you're not doing anything right. Making sure that, you know, things are going wrong, right? Because why? Because you're telling a story and the universe is supporting that story. Your subconscious is like that. It doesn't make any judgments. It just says, okay, all right. I had a client that didn't want to go do some family thing that was happening. So they told the family, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it out there. I'm feeling a little under the weather, but they weren't. And a half hour after they said it, they said a head cold just hit them out of nowhere.
Yes.
You can see that. So I said, see how powerful that story is? As soon as you said, oh, I'm under the weather, boom, you were under the weather. So the universe is always supporting us and it's just a neutral. It's neutral in that way. And then you have Big Brother or whatever you want to call this agency that's collecting your data. I think it's big business a lot of the time.
It is.
Right? Like we say Big Brother, like Big Brother is, I'm not saying there isn't any agency there, but it's a little paranoid, right? It's a little bit in that area where people are watching everything I do. Not to say that they're, you know, these things do happen. I mean, drive down the road, there's cameras that'll take pictures of you on a red light and send you a ticket in the mail, right? That feels like I'm being watched. And some cities have cameras like, whoa, like everywhere. But big business is collecting data points on you as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's why whenever I open Facebook, all of my sidebars and little extra areas are filled with beautiful things that people are trying to sell me.
Right. Isn't that amazing?
I'm always like, they know me so well. Why do they know me so well, right? Do they know me so well because they're spying on me? Mm. Or is it just because I'm constantly searching and shopping and looking up things and liking posts on Facebook and Instagram that have pictures of beautiful things, right? It's like there are tens of thousands of maybe hundreds of thousands of data points on people. But I don't know that, you know, I'm sure there's some connection between all of that, but a lot of it's just big business. We are the product. We are the product.
That's a bit of a shock the first time we hear that. The first time we're told that's a little shocking. It's a little bit of startling. Wait, what do you mean? What do you mean I'm the product? What are you talking about?
Right. Because when someone places an ad on Facebook to sell something, they know who they want, right? This is why journals for sale show up in my feed that have the picture of the moon on them and, you know, all these things. I was like, why? Well, because I used to run a program where we followed the moon phases because I'm always talking about journaling. Like I'm giving them this information and then they're selling me to that company that makes those journals.
Right.
A company says, look, I want women that are of this age and that like to journal and that love pictures of the moon and, you know, all these other data points. This is who we want you to show this ad to. So they pay Facebook for me. I'm the product. So how do I feel about that? Well, I think to some degree, every time we check that little box that says, okay, right? You know, you go to download an app or whatever. Have you read our, yes, you know.
I'm actually one of the few people who reads those, believe it or not. I know that makes me strange, but I really do read those. I've actually, believe it or not, there was at least two occasions, actually one very recently, where I read the terms of service for a website and found something in the terms of service that directly contradicted the main offer being made by the website. And I pointed out to them, they said, that's been up there for 10 years. We didn't even know it was there.
Because no one reads it, not even them.
Nobody reads it.
Right. Yeah. So I have read some of them before, but I'm not going to pretend that I read every single one, especially when a lot of times I do click on it and start to read it, and then I realize it's like 75 pages. I'm like, oh, you know that you're going to get to the end of it and weigh it and say, okay, anyway. So it's just an app, right? But I think that that's it. I think it has to do with our own choices, our own boundaries or lack of boundaries, and what we're willing to most of the time to just provide. Like, we provide that. And it's a different energy altogether to say, you know, that to think that, to get paranoid about, or that's kind of the extreme version, but to worry about that people are getting that information from us in some way that, you know, that we're not in agreement with. Most of the time, we're in agreement. We agree tacitly, but we agree. What are your thoughts on it? I mean, do you feel that too, that we, most of the time, it's us that's just giving all of that away?
Well, sure. I would even take it a step further and point out that this is not a new phenomenon. We tend to associate it with, you know, social media and so forth, because that's where a lot of it is done, but also with apps that have been created over the years. But it predates the computer era. People don't think about it this way, but it really does. If you were a subscriber to a newspaper, guess what? You were the product. Now, that's not the way it was originally sold. It was originally sold as advertising on a newspaper where the news reporters were, you know, doing all this breaking news stuff, so they had good readership, and that's what they were selling. But really, the readers were being sold. That was the whole point, that the advertiser wanted to reach the reader. The only real difference was the advertiser didn't know anything about you, other than you read the New York Times or whatever it was. That was it, you know, but you were still the product. So I guess the first question that enters my mind is, because I've been aware of this issue as a person who's worked with computers and computer programs to an extent, since the beginning of the computer age, I've been aware of this issue for a long, long time. And I remember the first time I became aware of it, I had two thoughts that occurred to me. The first thought was, why are people upset about the advertising side of it when the advertisers won't kill you? It's the governments that kill. So why are you so upset about the advertisers? That was my first thought. My second thought was, what are you worried they're going to do? Okay, so they've got this data that, by the way, you volunteered to give to them because you said you clicked that okay button, right? You said okay to the terms of service. So you volunteered to give it to them. What are you afraid they're going to do with it? And the moment I asked that question, I said to myself, I'm focusing on fear. Why do I want to focus on fear?
Yeah.
What's the point of that? So literally, I mean, well, first, this is a skill that I learned long before the computer age. I don't see ads anymore. I know that's strange because they're popping up all over the place. I get tunnel vision. An ad pops up, boom, I'm done. You know, I don't even know what the damn thing said. It's like, oh, I recognize an ad. Move on, quick.
Yeah.
Like 99% of the ads that appear on the page, I couldn't even tell you what they are.
I think that sometimes ads can be really annoying. Like, you know, they keep getting in the way, like some of these ads that will pop up over the top of what you're reading, and you have to kind of get rid of it before you can keep reading. And sometimes they keep doing that, or they kind of scroll up and down, you know, talking about like reading on your phone or reading on a PC. But I remember back before, you know, the computer age, subscribing to magazines. And magazines definitely have, you know, like the New York Times probably has a much wider, broader demographic, but magazines, they are pointed to artists or to women or to men or to whatever their demographic is. And I remember I loved the ads. That's part of the reason why I bought it. Like I wanted to see the new, whatever genre it was. I wanted to see what new was out there. I wanted to see what was available. So I never was really upset with the ads in magazines. I remember one time buying a magazine that was slightly more expensive than other magazines, and it was because it had no ads or some, or they sent me a, I think they sent me a sample copy of a magazine that had no ads. So instead of being, you know, a few dollars a copy, it was maybe $10 a copy, but there were no ads. And I was so disappointed when I looked at it. It's like, why do I want to, there's nothing in here. I want to see the ads. I'm not always like that about ads, but I think that now in this day and age, the ads are so tailor-made to us and our interests that to me, they're sort of even less annoying, but we are giving all of that information. It's hard to be involved in any kind of social media or virtual anything without giving that information. And so, you know, we talked about this before about this is kind of slightly veering off topic, but because we're saying Big Brother, right? Just the whole conspiracy theory idea. Conspiracies happen, but conspiracy theory and conspiracies are two different things. And there's a certain vibration with conspiracy theory that lends itself to paranoia. The vibration is the difference between that conspiracy theory. The vibration is mistrust. I don't trust the government. I don't trust these people that are in power. I don't trust the media. I don't trust. That leads to a very conspiracy theory, you know, path. And then the other vibration is we do put faith in something. So to say, well, people that believe in conspiracy theories are believing something they don't know all about. They don't know all the answers. They're believing something they can't see. And people that are spiritual or religious, they are also believing something they can't see. The difference is that in spirituality and religious belief, we're putting our faith in something, where in conspiracy theory, it's a mistrust of something. It's not a trust in something.
Good point. Yeah.
And so it's two different directions and two different, very different vibrations. And I think that those are the two different vibrations we're talking about with this question, with number one, trusting the universe, knowing the universe knows everything about us. And that the questioner said the universe is non-judgmental. Yes. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, mistrusting the government or an agency or Big Brother or whoever you want to mistrust, right? That leads to a totally different vibration. And yes, there's fear there. I think fear can be a really good thing. Fear is a human emotion that will serve us well if we pay attention to it and, you know, listen. Not that we live in fear and afraid of everything. That starts to get into the paranoia. That's different. But listening to, I mean, we should be, you know, a fear can be healthy, right? Fear of drowning, fear of fire. Yes. It's a reason that we just don't go sit in the middle of the bonfire, right? Because we know better. Right, right. That's not a good idea. There's a reason that.
Not to mention the fact that it's hot and it will actually burn you. It's very uncomfortable. So those are minor issues, but
there's a reason why we don't just jump off the boat in the deep end of the ocean and decide we're going to go for a little swim when we're not a great swimmer, or even if we are, maybe. Why? Because we have a healthy fear, a healthy respect of things that could be dangerous. So fear isn't always bad. The whole idea of, you know, not living in fear. Sometimes people use that as a reason to not just take common sense measures about things. And that's really not a useful way to look at it. We should, you know, take care of ourselves. But that's the way I think about it. I also obviously put my info out there to some degree because.
Oh, yeah. I think most of us do.
These advertisers, they know me inside and out.
Well, we announced it here on the show. If you'd like to reach Cindy Chavez, I mean, that's part of our podcast.
Yeah, right.
So, but the questioner, Avinash's question literally was, do you really care how much data is collected on you? And when I read that part of it, I immediately flashed back to about an hour ago when I was doing my research on being a public speaker. And I'm in the process of writing my basic speech that I plan to give. I've already figured out what audiences I want to give it to. And part of that speech, I was drawing, of course, on stuff that we talk about here on the show, because what am I going to draw on? I'm going to draw on stuff that I know about. Well, I was writing about the ARAS, the Ascending Reticular Activating System. And it occurred to me, that question is all about the ARAS. Do you really care? Well, if you don't care, you're not going to notice it. If you do care, you're going to notice it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why I said earlier, I don't even see the ads because I don't care. It's
yeah.
not that important to me. I got much more important things that I'm dealing with on a daily basis to get fretted out about that. Maybe I did all of my fretting about it, you know, 30 years ago when I first became aware that you could actually do this kind of thing with computers, but it didn't last very long. I mean, it's not like I spent months and years fretting about it. I said, okay, well, it's there. So what? What am I going to do? Move on. Next.
Well, my youngest son, at one time in his life when he was probably college age, old enough to drive, and then, you know, early 20s, all through that period of time, every time he went to a restaurant, and I mean every time he went to a restaurant, the people next to the table to where he was at had a screaming baby. Every time. And it got to be a family joke where we would like, hey, you want to go out with us to grab some sushi or something? No, we don't want to go with you. There'll be a screaming baby next to the table, because there always was, right? And it was so funny because I was trying to explain to him, you are so focused on this that it's just always happening. And that's that reticular activation, because if it wouldn't have been bothering him, he wouldn't really have noticed that there was a crying baby.
Right.
Right. But because he was so in tune to it with that reticular activation, that even if the baby was just fussing a little bit, to him, it was like a big deal that was very annoying. Why? Because he was worried that it was going to happen. He was completely focused on it. He was looking out for it. Eventually, you know, I think he did learn to focus somewhere else and it stopped. But it was really funny when it was happening. And that's like you said, you don't notice the ads. I guarantee there is someone else who is having the opposite experience than you with that. They are so annoyed about the ads. The ads keep popping up. They're getting aggravated. And it seems like there's just always more and more ads. And, you know, reticular activation is like that. That's how it works, is that we become, our brain, the system in our brain becomes aware and starts filtering out everything that's not that, because that's the thing. Do you have that number? We've talked about this before and I can never pull the number off the top of my head. The number of how many bits of information is coming at us, like in a minute or in an hour. It's huge.
I've heard so many different figures and I'm not sure which one I believe anyway, but it's always a large number. It's never small.
No, it's very, very large. And the point is that it would overwhelm us. We would implode or explode, or our brain would shut down from overwhelm. There's no way we can process all of the information coming at us. So we filter most of it out. And if we are attuned to something, aware of something, and then to add another layer, vibrationally in alignment with something, we're not filtering it out. We're selecting it. It's kind of like we're filtering it in. Like, you know, when you're shopping, see, I'm a shopper, and you get to pick the filter. You filter it down to your size and the color you want. And pretty soon everything that they're showing you is in those parameters. That's the reticular activation system. Amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
It's also quite valuable. I mean, people, there is a small subset of the population that does not have a viably functioning ARAS. And they are the people who fall into the autism spectrum. their brains are not able to do that filtering, and that's why they exhibit the autism characteristics, or to some degree that they do. If they fall within the spectrum, maybe to a small degree, maybe to a large degree, it varies from one person to the next. So be grateful that you have the ARAS. It's a wonderful thing. It actually saves you from levels of insanity, among other things.
I mean, it's like input overload. Just yeah. too much stuff coming at you. And it makes total sense why that would be just completely overwhelming. So yeah, we have sensory gates that close off, you know, what's too much for us. So yeah, that's interesting. Interesting well, place to get to in our conversation.
Well, I thought it was a very ARAS moment that here I was writing about it and, you know, kind of researching what I already knew about it just to get my wording straight. And then an hour later, I'm seeing an exact example of how the ARAS works and why it applies. I'm thinking, well, yeah, there's a law of attraction moment right there. But it's also a filtering moment because I reopened my mind to the whole concept of the reticular activating system. And sure enough, I get an example that just pops right into my experience immediately. Within an hour, you know, and about the only reason that it didn't show up sooner is that the podcast hadn't started yet. I mean, that was about it. So, you know, you get it kind of both at the same time, both the law of attraction and RAS happening at the same time. I think the most interesting thing from my perspective where RAS is concerned, where this whole question of data collection is concerned, and where our ability to reprogram it is concerned is tied to what I was writing about in my little talk I was starting to structure. And in that talk, I was basically emphasizing the audience that I'm proposing to talk to are college students who are dealing with stress and pressure, perhaps dealing with depression, anxiety, that sort of thing. So I'm assuming that a significant portion of the audience that I'll be talking to are people who are already kind of stuck in that mode, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to be pointing out to them that the things that they're wanting in life are already coming to them. They don't see it. They're not aware of it. And the reason is this ARAS. So I'm trying to present it as a way of, this is why I made the allusion earlier to how wonderful it is. I'm trying to show them this is a good thing. This gives you the opportunity to control your experience. You don't have to settle for being depressed or anxious or whatever. You can actually shift the way that you experience the universe, and you can actually feel better in the process. And do better in school, or, you know, do better with whatever it is you're going to do in life. Maybe you decide not to stay in school once you feel better. I mean, who knows what your decision's going to be. But the point is, you get to be back in control again. And I think the same thing is true here. We get to control what our experience is going to be with, you know, all that data that's going out there. We give off data all the time. It's just that some people have figured out how to collect it. The data, it's not like the data wasn't there before. It's like, right. You know, well, this data was all in the closet until Facebook came along. No, the data was out there. It was available to anyone who could figure out how to collect it. It's just nobody figured out how to collect it. I remember about, I think it was about 14, 15 years ago, I went to an online meeting, webinar type meeting, where they were talking about the ability of this one particular company that was selling their services to companies that were far larger than my little venture. They were offering to take an email address and then tell you everything that was available about that email address. You get that, give them that one email address. They could tell you the name, the address, the phone number, you know, the family members, birth dates, you know, graduation dates, they could give you the whole thing off of an email address. And I was saying this, saying, whoa, that's amazing. And it's so intrusive and all this other stuff. I said, yeah, but wait a minute. The data's been there all along. Why am I getting so upset about it? So I keep having that same point of view every single time I run into this issue. Oh my God, terrible things are happening. Yeah, except that it's been there all along. Back when I was in high school, we didn't even hardly have computers. I mean, the computer lab was a terminal, a dumb terminal that connected to the state university, you know, some 20 miles away. And all you could do was type in the basic language. There was no desktop. There was nothing like right. that. That was the extent of our computers. And we were all giving off data like crazy. We just didn't think of it as data. I mean, what's high school like? High school is one great big data gathering operation. Right. And I'm not talking about the classes. I'm talking about all the interpersonal relationships. You know, it's crazy how much data gets passed around there. So it's not like there's no data. It's not like data just kind of, you know, appeared out of nowhere. Now it's just being extracted from the ethers.
Just smarter and faster machines got involved. Yeah. That's all. Yeah, that's what all. It is. And that freaks people out sometimes.
Well, then, so my message to them is, were you freaked out before? I mean, assuming that you're not, you know, 15 years old, so you can't remember back that far.
They were. I mean, when you think about it, conspiracy theories are not new.
This is true. Yes, very true.
As a matter of fact, if you study, and I won't get too political, but I mean, it's just history. If you study history, the right wing of the political, you know, systems in the United States were using conspiracy theories back in the 1800s. There were no computers, right? It was all just word of mouth or this or that. But it was like just that whole idea, because why would you worry about the data if you didn't have some other piece of the story that felt fearful, right? Like someone's going to use the data in some, you know, with some evil intent, or that someone has stolen the data from you, because of course we don't want to feel like we've been robbed or raped in some way, right? And so it's like those stories have to sort of be attached to it for it to cause a real problem in our mind, and hence in our vibration, is that we get wrapped up in those other parts of the story that have always been around. It's just that, you know, with machine learning and computers and the how fast the knowledge base is growing exponentially, it just is a little more obvious, I think, now than it was then, when life was slower, when, you know, you didn't have instant communication, instant connection, instant all the time. That's the other thing, is that we humans are small group primates, and we thrive in community, but we're made to be in a community of maybe hundreds of people, not millions of people. And, you know, that's why there's that sort of problem or issue that can come about with social media. It's like when we're not used to having 700 or 7,000 or 7 million, you know, people approving of something that we do. Right. Everyone likes approval. Of course, we're wired to feel good about approval, but we're also made in a way that the approval would normally come from a much smaller group. And now it's possible to get that approval or rejection, right? It's like, no one liked last week's 7,000 people liked my post, and this week only 6 people liked it, so I feel rejected. Where without all of that, 6 people giving you a high five would have felt pretty good, right?
Yes, that's true. That's true. I actually made me think of a question I want to raise. I'll raise that in a second. There's just one other point I wanted to make about this major data collection thing before we move on, which is there are certain pieces of data we don't want out there. And I think most of us are pretty careful about it. Like I really don't go out of my way to publish my credit card number, expiration date.
Correct.
And, you know, I just don't do
number.
That. Yeah. I mean, it's just like common sense. And the fact is, well, I'm not sure how common it is, to be honest, but that's another topic entirely. The fact is, those of us who are, you know, demonstrating some degree of concern about making sure that certain things stay private, it's not like we have this massive amount of data we have to keep private. It's just, it's a small subset, and it's manageable. We can handle it, assuming, of course, that the electronic tools are there to work with. And, you know, for the most part, they're there. So that's all I really ever am concerned about. And the concern lasts about long enough to say, okay, I just ordered something. You know, do I have a secure connection? I verified that. Yes, I do. Is it through a merchant that I trust? Yes, it is. Am I using a card that I know I have consumer protection on? Yes, it is. You know, things like that. I just take those steps, and I take them now so effortlessly, so automatically, I don't even think about them anymore.
Well, and not everybody does that. And that's important that people should recognize that, right? That we should not just be giving out information like that. If someone calls you and asks you for, we got one of those spammy, weird calls the other day, and we were listening to the voicemail, and it's like this computer voice that says, your social security number has been suspended. We were like, what?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? I mean, you're right though. That's a good point to make, is that there's a small amount of information that's private and should stay private.
Absolutely.
But most of the data collected is not that.
No.
Right.
And that's a big differentiator, I think. That's a big difference between the stuff that really needs to be private and the rest that, well, so what? So they know that my hair is white. I mean, is this really news? I mean, come on. This is not a big deal. You got
I'm
that
on a
point
podcast,
good on you.
Right?
I can live with that one. Let's see, what was the other point that I wanted to bring up? Something that you had said that cued something in my mind. And of course, now it's slipped away. It'll have to come back in just a moment.
What was I talking about?
I don't know. I can't remember what it was. It was something along the same line, but it just kind of slipped away. So that's right. It'll come back.
I was talking about the spammy call that we got. We've gotten several of them, and they really are hysterical because whoever wrote them, my social security number has not been suspended, I guarantee you. Not sure what that means.
Yeah. Well, there are certain of these spams you can read just from the way that they write the thing that they really don't understand the concept. You know, it's like saying your phone number's been canceled or something. Like, what? Wait a second. Phone numbers aren't cancelable. You just can't cancel a phone number. But, well, whatever.
So, I have a question for you. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. No, you first.
Well, the question. Talking about reticular activation and recognizing, you know, knowing that that system is active, I mean, so that we can consciously take advantage of it, right? I mean, that's the idea that you're talking about, that if we don't know it's there, we're going to be, it's going to be activated maybe towards things that are, and around stories we have that are not creating what we want in our life. But if we do know it's there, then we can somehow use that system in a conscious way to be noticing opportunities, to be noticing beauty, to be noticing things around us that make our life better. So I know this is sort of like putting you on the spot, but I started thinking about it. Okay, how do you do that? What's the number one tip for, you know, turning on that system in a way that you're conscious of it and it's working for you instead of against you?
Well, that's the question I was trying to answer as I was starting to put my notes together for my talk. How do I address, because that's really, it's the famous phrase, the elephant in the room. That elephant that's in the room is, how do I use this thing? Okay, yeah. So you've told me about this thing. What do I do with it? Especially if I'm an anxious, depressed college student who feels like the world is against him and considering, taking drastic measure to end my life or something like that. How do I use that? Well, that was the question I was trying to ask myself. And I was kind of putting myself into the place of somebody who's feeling that way and kind of, because all of us at one point or another in our lives have experienced depression of some kind or anxiety or, you know, really severe stress, anger, rage, something along that line. And, you know, so we can kind of put ourselves in that place. And I was remembering that one of the things that happens most often is that we kind of lose track of the idea that there could be anything but what we're feeling. That we're almost in a space where we can't even see what it's like to feel good anymore. Feeling good is not even in the realm of possibilities. Now it's just a question of, do I select between this thing I'm afraid of or that thing I'm afraid of, or this thing I'm depressed about or that thing I'm anxious about? And that's literally the limit of our apparent choices. So I'm asking myself, okay, so what can I do to help that person make one quick step right there in, you know, the audience where I'm giving the talk? And so I went to my Abraham Hicks book, Ask and It Is Given, because they've got the 22 processes in the back. And one of the cool things that they do is, it was confusing actually the first time I read it, but now I understand it, is they actually rank each of the different processes based on what your emotional state is.
Right. Yes. And I remember that.
The higher vibe ones are toward the front. The lower vibe ones are toward the back. So I went to the back and I started reading backwards what the different processes were. And there were like three or four that were for people who are in really depressed states. And I realized that each one of them could work in certain circumstances. None of them really matched up to the college student that I was trying to think about. But there was one in particular that I could match with another one that was a little bit higher vibe one and combine the two together. And I thought, this would make a really cool little process. The one that Abraham had was a process of taking whatever your negative self-talk is about topic X, whatever the thing is that's depressing you or making you anxious, and trying to find another way of saying the same thing, but saying it in a more positive, affirmative way rather than, this is a terrible thing that's happening, here's something I prefer instead, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, well, that's not bad. But what if I combine that with the wouldn't it be nice if process, which is like number 14 or something like that. So it's a higher vibe process.
Right.
And so I started writing that out. And as I started writing it out, I thought, this is a really cool process, because what it actually ends up doing is it encourages the person who's in that depressed, anxious, you know, just really state to just find one or two ways to think a little bit differently about it and then ask, wouldn't it be nice if I felt this instead? and just identify what that this is. What would be the feeling? In fact, I was going to a conversation you and I had many, many moons ago about, you used the phrase, I feel rich in an affirmation. And we were talking about how powerful feeling, putting the word feel in there, was much more powerful than saying I am rich or something along that line, because we can believe it. It's easier to buy into. So I was taking that formula and applying it to, well, instead of saying I feel trapped or I feel depressed or I feel, you know, like my professor hates me or something like that, what can I turn that feeling into in terms of what I wish it would feel? I wish I would feel that the professor liked me. I wish that I would feel that the course was fun. I wish, and I started piecing it together that way. I thought that's something that somebody who is depressed could actually buy into. So what I guess the whole point of my story here is I was actually going through the process of kind of putting myself into that person's place who I was talking to and asking myself, how can I structure my talk to address where they are using this concept of the RAS? And in the process of using the concept of the RAS, I realized what we're really doing is addressing the question that the user, that the listener called in with, Avinash called in about, well, what about these data points? Well, the data points we're talking about are the person's own data points.
Yeah.
We're asking them to connect to their own data points and then to rewrite the way they're thinking about their data points.
What so I love about
that. It was a fun
that
exercise.
I love the first part that we are trying to say it in a slightly different way, maybe that's more positive, because right there, we're tapping into that right brain creativity. You know, the left brain is so logical. The left brain is the one that's like, no, you are broke, right?
Right. Yes.
You're failing this class, right?
And
it's
that's
like,
right.
You don't have any friends, whatever. It's just like, but when we ask ourselves how could I say this in a different way? We immediately start the wheels turning to discover a different perspective. And that perspective, we're only shooting for, because we're still talking about the same thing, the same feeling, the same experience, the same circumstance. We're trying to describe it in a little bit different way. So we're not trying to jump to the top of the emotional scale. We're just moving up a little bit, maybe just almost a lateral move, but just a little bit better. And once we get to that little bit better, then we're going on the, wouldn't it be nice? So then we're tapping into a preference that's also creative. Like one of the examples I heard you say was, my teacher hates me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's like, oh, my teacher hates me. You know, as a coach, I would immediately say, what makes you think that? Right. Well, he never calls on me or whatever. And we may come to the conclusion, well, how could you say it in a different way? And it would be that it would be getting a little more straightforward instead of putting a judgment about this person hates you. It's actually just that this person isn't calling on you. And you're making it mean something about you. Like you're making that meaning. You're telling that story. So what if we said it a different way and just said, well, if he doesn't call on me often, wouldn't it be nice if he called on me more often?
Yes.
And right. And that's just a different vibration. Like even when I'm just saying it in the example, I can feel the difference. Just feels a little bit better. So that's a really great way. And then what we're doing is we're opening up the reticular activation system to notice how often we do get called on. Maybe we have six teachers and five of them call on us all the time. And we're sort of focused over here on the fact that, you know, it's like my son and the crying baby in the restaurant, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah.
So that's a really nice process that works really well, I think, when you're down there at that place feeling a lot of stress and anxiety.
Yeah, I think so too.
You're not and I'm switching still, it up too much, right? You're just
No. And I'm still kind of honing it. I'm trying to, you know, get the words condensed down so it's, you know, easier to teach and so forth. But I love the way the whole thing is kind of playing. And I'm still trying to work out how do I get the word feel in there for them every time? Because one of the things that we know about somebody who's in a really low vibration place is they're very often kind of disconnected from what they're feeling about it.
Mm. You
know, yes, they actually feel pretty miserable in that depressed, anxious state, but they often have trouble connecting to it, because I remember what that's like when I was in that state. You feel numb, you know, you just kind of numb yourself to everything. And if you aren't feeling numb, then you take drugs or alcohol or do something to kind of numb it because you're feeling so miserable about it, you know? So it's what I really want to do is get them to kind of reconnect to the idea of feeling and to have a way of making it feel good, because they're not used to the feeling good lately. Yeah. And if I can just kind of help them to start reconnecting to feeling good right now, right here in the meeting hall or in the conference hall or wherever I'm giving this talk, or maybe it's online, maybe it's a virtual talk, then I'm getting them one step further, one step closer to being able to actively take control of reprogramming that ARAS. And that's the goal, to get them to take that control, to actually do their own reprogramming. Because then they'll climb out themselves. I don't have to pull them out. They'll pull themselves out.
Right. I love it. I love that system. I remember whenever we talk about it, I always think about this story that I was in California staying with a friend, and I had started explaining to her the reticular activation system. I'm not sure why. We were just having a conversation, and she had never heard about that before. And I started explaining to her what it was. Mm-hmm. And I use the example that you hear all the time. It's like, you know how maybe you've never seen a yellow Volkswagen Bug in your neighborhood, and then you buy one, and as you're driving at home, you see six of them, and you're like, oh my goodness, they're everywhere. Like, I didn't realize, because now your mind is on it, you're focused on it, and you start seeing them. They were there. You just didn't see them. You filtered them out. They weren't important to you, but now they are, because you own one now. I was telling her that, and she said, well, you won't see a car like mine anywhere, because I have this late model Camry and it's got a gold package on it. And who puts a gold package on a beige Camry? And, you know, she was giving all these details about it. And she said, I've never seen another car like mine. We won't see another car like mine. So I said, well, okay, well, it's, you know what I mean though, right? You know what I mean. And she said, yeah. So then we left and we drove 2 miles to brunch from her house and back. And in that 4 miles total round trip or less, we saw like, I don't know, 6 cars like her, like they were everywhere. She could not stop laughing. She laughed and laughed and laughed, because realizing that this perception that we had that there are none of these cars anywhere, you'll never see one, was not correct.
Yeah.
It was our experience and it might have been our truth. And we might have seen it as a fact and been willing to just bet $100 on it, right? It's like, no, I don't see these. They aren't around. And yet it wasn't true. And so that's kind of what the reticular activation system, I always laugh about that, but so much of the time, like I wonder about my owl. You're going to laugh, but it's like, okay. So I got focused on attracting an owl and I live in the city. My office is in the middle of the city. And one day I heard something at my window. Within 24 hours of asking to see an owl, I look up and there's a ginormous owl fluttering, hitting wingtips, hitting my window, making noise, pop, 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 all the way up the window with a wingspan of like, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet. You think those owls are out there all the time? And I just
it does make you wonder, doesn't it?
I read an article recently about, it was from someone writing from a, you know, kind of multiverse perspective, but all this physics stuff they did in the lab saying the world out there is nothing like what we think it is. Mm. That everything we experience in our head through our brain. And we think that we are seeing a pretty good replication of it, but everything in the labs say that's not true at all. So that's another discussion for another day that could be very deep.
Well, of course, there's also the flip side to the exact same argument, which is that the world is exactly what you think it is all the time, right. Every single time.
And they're both true, right.
And they're both true.
But I was thinking about that. I was like, oh gosh. So every day there are owls outside my window.
That's right.
Just tuned into it that one time.
Well, that's what I was thinking about actually with this, you know, the subtopic I was writing about today with the ARAS. I was thinking to myself, my God, I mean, with all this stimuli coming by that we don't notice, right. How often are we failing to notice that one thing that we're really wanting that will change our life? How
all
often
time,
is it coming by?
Because the thing is not in our story.
Yeah.
Because we keep talking about how it's not there.
Right.
We keep focusing.
That's haunting. That to me is much worse than all that data. The people right? worried about the data being collected by Facebook. That's nothing compared to the data I'm missing that's coming by my life right now that I just ignore completely that I want in the first place. Yeah, to me, that's a much bigger issue.
Nothing compared to the amount of data that I'm suppressing and ignoring filtering out and not seeing.
Right. I mean, I know that there's some, I think it's a TV special that was done on that whole thing about how much Facebook collects and so forth. I'm thinking, guys, you're looking at the wrong program. Look at the program you're creating for yourself every single day, and you keep rewriting it over and over and over and over again. And you're worried about that? Really?
Right. Write a different program. Well, that's it.
Write a different program.
Tell a different story. You know, when we think about sometimes the things that we create in our life that we're unhappy about, when we think about the number of times we've told the story of them, right? The number of times that we've told that story, that the result, the end of that story is this condition, this experience, this circumstance we're not crazy about. And we've told that story so many times. How could it not just appear? So if we would just change the story, like you said, and I'm not even talking about, you know, making up some story that some vision that's not real yet, but seems better. I'm not even going there. I'm just saying to slightly modify the story to where we can see it from a slightly better perspective and start telling it that way and see what happens. You know, like sometimes I tell people who are looking for a relationship and they say they are single, I ask them to start saying that they're available.
Oh, nice. I like that shift. Yeah.
Right. Because that little shift, it may mean the same thing to some people. They still say, oh, okay, you don't have a partner. But when they're saying single, it's they are single. They are alone. They are one person. They're not part of a couple. They're a single, not a couple. And as soon as they say I'm available, it shifts something. It opens something up. It's not a huge change, but vibrationally, it's very different.
Well, I'd say it is huge, actually. I mean, in a good way.
Yes.
It's a very huge change because that new way of describing it is going to eliminate every anti-available thought that I've been focusing on by being, quote, single, unquote.
Right. So in that way, yes, it is huge. It's a huge shift.
Yeah. Right?
But it's not a huge change in it's just a minor shift in verbally in how we say
exactly.
It. It's just choosing some words that feel a little bit better instead of saying, you know, I was in a terrible relationship and telling that story over and over, it's, you know, I've healed from some bad relationships, but I'm in the process now of being ready to make a healthy relationship or
right.
You know, are in a healthy relationship or whatever. You can say it in a different way. You're still kind of, you can still tell the story that's your truth with a better spin on it. You're still telling the truth. It's just a better way to present it. And when you do that, the vibration will change and things will start to shift a little bit. And then you start telling that story and then you tell that story in a slightly better way. It just gets better and better. Isn't that actually like an Abraham Hicks thing? It's like,
it
just keeps getting better and better, right? Better and better.
That's right. Keep telling a better feeling story, a better feeling story, a better feeling story over and over and over again. Yeah. That's Abraham Hicks for sure. Yeah. It's also a stream of David, by the way, too, although he says it a little bit differently. But essentially, it's change your perspective, pull back, get a different view on the whole thing and just see the whole thing differently. It's basically the same message. Just want to remind people who are not taking advantage of it, who might be thinking about it, taking advantage of it. The Elevate Today app has that form in it for sending in a question. That's how Avinash sent his question in. And we want to invite you to do the same. Take advantage of the fact that Cindy is a world-class relationship coach. And you know, send in a relationship question. I'll make sure that Cindy answers it the next time that she's on the program. But take advantage of it and you know, share the app with others too, because other people have their questions that need to be answered. So, and by the way, if you want to reach Cindy, you can actually do it through the app.
Yes.
It's something I want to point out. You can do it through, just go to the co-host page under the goodies section and go to Cindy's paragraph and you'll see a picture of her. And there's a little link there. Click the link. It takes you right to where you can contact her. So take advantage.
And I love hearing from you. I love it. I love getting your messages, your questions, your comments, like just, sometimes people just give me a shout out to say hello. Definitely. Take advantage of that contact form and shoot a message over and give me a shout out, say hello. Yeah.
Well, this has been great. We took a very odd question and we turned it into a really good conversation. So thank you very much, Cindy. And I look forward to talking to you again next week. Thank you, live streamers, who were very quiet, but very attentive. We had a nice audience and they were saying almost nothing. So we had their attention. It was good. So thank you guys very much. Thank you, especially to our podcast listeners as well. And we'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Hi, everyone.